Welcome to the deep dive. For you listening today, our mission is to take a really close structural look at the digital footprint of a modern biological sciences researcher.
Yeah, specifically, we're exploring the personal website and CV of Dr. Miguel Prudencio.
Right. We've pulled the menus, the text, the bio sketches, and even the course materials right off his site to see, you know, what it actually takes to build a career in high-level science today.
And before we jump into all that material, we should probably establish some strict boundaries for our analysis.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Just to keep this deep dive laser focused, we are looking exclusively at the architecture and text of his personal website.
Right. So we are deliberately ignoring all the noise of any external media you might find out there.
Exactly. Like his YouTube channel, for instance. Mm-hmm. We're totally ignoring that.
Yeah, because by isolating our focus strictly to his, you know, self-curated professional hub, we get a much clearer picture of how he categorizes his own life's work.
Yeah, and what he truly values.
Which brings us to the hook of this whole exploration. Usually when we look at a resume or a CV, there's this underlying expectation of a linear, predictable story.
Right. It's like reading a train schedule.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly like a train schedule. You start at point A, you acquire a specific skill, you get on the track, and you just ride at point B.
Mm.
Like if you're an accountant, your resume shows progressively more senior accounting roles. It's clean, it's categorized, and it's very easy to put into a box.
It creates a really comforting narrative, I think. We are kind of conditioned to believe that expertise means digging one single incredibly deep hole in a very narrow field.
But then, you know, you encounter the digital footprint of a top-tier scientific researcher like this, and suddenly that neat little train schedule just goes completely out the window.
Oh, totally out the window.
Because at a quick, superficial glance at the homepage, his site tells you he is a highly specialized malaria researcher.
Right.
But the deeper you read into the site menus, the more sprawling the landscape becomes. I mean, you uncover an entrepreneur. You find a patent inventor. You stumble across a COVID-19 task force leader. You see a passionate advocate for science communication.
The sheer breadth of the site really challenges our basic assumptions.
It really does.
Because we often picture scientists sequestered away in a laboratory, staring through microscopes, you know, and entirely removed from the mechanics of the outside world.
Like they don't care about politics or business.
Right, exactly. But this website paints a picture of a researcher who is deeply entangled in all of those spheres simultaneously.
Well, to understand why he has to wear all these different hats, I feel like we first have to understand the foundational puzzle he's trying to solve.
Yeah, the core science.
Right. So looking at his labs and biosketch sections, his primary role is as a group leader. He heads the Prudencio lab at GIM.
That's the Gulbenkian Institute for Molecular Medicine in Portugal.
Right, exactly. And his absolute focus is malaria, but very specifically, the Plasmodium liver stages and anti-malarial intervention. He's searching for anti-plasmodial drugs.
Huh.
And developing what the site calls whole sporzo vaccination.
Yeah, and we really need to unpack the biology there because those technical terms kind of dictate everything else he does.
Let's do it.
So a sporozoite is essentially the infectious, highly mobile spore phase of the malaria parasite.
Okay.
When an infected mosquito bites you, it injects these sporozoites into your bloodstream. But, and this is key, they don't stay there.
They move.
Yeah, they make a rapid beeline straight for your liver.
Okay, so I was actually reading through the site's about malaria section.
Right.
And the way I picture this liver stage is, well, it's kind of like a sleeper agent infiltrating a building.
Oh, I like that. A sleeper agent.
Right. Because the parasite slips into the liver completely unnoticed by the body's alarm systems.
Yep. The immune system has no idea it's there.
Exactly. So it just camps out in the lobby, quietly multiplying from a few parasites into tens of thousands, basically gathering its forces before it breaks out and trashes the whole house.
Meaning the bloodstream.
Right, the bloodstream. And that's when you get the severe fever, the chills, and all the life-threatening symptoms.
That analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. It is a completely silent incubation period.
Wow.
The parasite is hidden inside the liver cells, which makes it an incredibly difficult target for drugs, but it is also the strategic bottleneck of the disease.
But wait, why dedicate your entire lab to this specific sleeper agent phase?
What do you mean?
Well, if it's so hidden and hard to target in the liver, wouldn't it just be easier to wait and treat the symptoms later when we know the disease is active in the blood?
Okay, so the problem with treating the blood stage is that you're essentially trying to put out a raging fire that is already consuming the building.
Oh, okay.
The damage is actively occurring, and the parasite is constantly mutating to evade whatever drugs you throw at it.
So it's a moving target by then.
Exactly. So Prudencio's focus on the litter stage represents this massive shift from damage control to genuine fire prevention. If you can intercept that burglar in the lobby, or, train the immune system to recognize it there, you stop the disease from ever manifesting in the first place.
Which I guess brings us to the whole sporozoite vaccination mentioned across his site.
Yes.
Like, he has a specific section dedicated to something called PBVAC.
Right. So a traditional vaccine might just use a single protein from a virus or parasite to trigger an immune response.
Like, just a piece of it.
Yeah, just a tiny piece. But a whole sporozoite vaccine uses the entire intact parasite.
Wait, intact, like alive.
Well, usually weakened or genetically altered, so it can't actually make you sick, but it's whole.
Ah, okay, I see.
And by exposing the immune system to the whole organism, the body learns to recognize the complete profile of the intruder. It mounts a much broader, like more robust defense.
Okay, so he's got this intense, laser-focused biological mission. He's trying to stop a microscopic sleeper agent before it wakes up. But because he's targeting the parasite so early, he can't really rely on standard treatments. He has to invent entirely new experimental methodologies.
Yeah, and that creates a massive friction point.
Right, which transitions right into the business of
And
science.
the transition from the lab bench to the real world.
Yes, and if you look at the research and outputs and other skills tabs on his site, that friction is just totally obvious.
Oh, absolutely.
Because on one hand, you see the output of a heavy-hitting academic, right? Author of over 160 scientific articles, winner of several innovation prizes.
Standard academic stuff.
But then you see a patent section, you see an entrepreneurship menu, you see consultantships.
Right.
Crucially, he lists himself as a founding member of an IMM spin-off company called Roplevac.
Yeah, and moving from writing academic papers to founding a biotech spinoff is a monumental shift in daily responsibilities.
I really have to challenge this setup, though.
How so?
Well, when I see a CV listing 160 plus peer-reviewed papers alongside founding a company and managing patents, my instinct is to assume something has to be superficial.
You think it's just for show?
I mean, you can't be a world-class bench scientist and a startup CEO simultaneously, right? The skill sets are totally different.
That's a fair point.
Like navigating venture capital, negotiating patent law, running clinical trials, it's entirely different from running a biology lab. Doesn't one of these areas inevitably suffer?
It definitely looks like an impossible balancing act on paper, but in modern translational biology, you actually can't have one without the other.
Really?
Yeah. Let me explain the mechanics of why a researcher is practically forced to become an entrepreneur today. In the biotech world, there is this concept known as the valley of death.
The valley of death, meaning the gap where good ideas go to die.
Precisely. Public grants and university funding are great for the discovery phase, finding out how the liver stage works in the first place.
Right.
And on the other end, massive pharmaceutical companies are great at manufacturing and selling a proven drug. But the space in the middle, taking a raw discovery, securing the intellectual property, and running multi-million dollar clinical trials to prove it's actually safe and effective, that is a financial wasteland.
Wow, okay.
Traditional academic grants just won't fund commercial drug development.
So if a scientist just publishes their brilliant discovery in a journal and stops there, the cure literally never leaves the page. Nobody picks it up.
Millions of potential treatments have died in that valley because researchers weren't equipped or, they simply refused to navigate the commercialization process.
Okay, it's so wild.
So by putting entrepreneurship and patents right on his site's main menu, and by founding Roplevac, he is essentially taking responsibility for the delivery mechanism of his science.
He's making sure it survives the valley.
Exactly. The spin-off company isn't some distraction from his lab work. It is the required corporate vehicle to translate his lab work into a tangible vial of medicine.
You know, that structural necessity, that ability to build complex organizations to deliver science, actually sheds light on another massive, totally unexpected section of his CV.
Oh, the COVID-19 section.
Yeah. Because if you're scrolling through this site, you're deeply immersed in malaria, mosquitoes, and liver immunology. And then out of nowhere, you hit a menu item simply titled COVID-19.
A completely different pathogen and a totally different type of global health emergency.
Right. And according to the site, Prudencio was deeply involved in setting up the IMM's task force for SARS-CoV-2 diagnostics. And this wasn't just casual consulting. This was building high-throughput diagnostic systems during a global panic.
Yeah, and to understand how a malaria researcher pivots to a respiratory virus like that, we have to look at the underlying infrastructure he spent decades building.
Right.
Because high-throughput diagnostics isn't just about knowing how to test one single patient.
It's logistics.
Exactly. It's about engineering a logistical system capable of processing thousands of samples a day, flawlessly, without cross-contamination, and under extreme time pressure.
The analogy that keeps coming to my mind is a peacetime general versus a wartime general.
Oh, that's a bet.
Because for years, he was doing peacetime preparation. The site shows he was running the IMM BSL-3 facility and developed a biosafety curriculum.
Right.
So he was quietly building this incredibly robust infrastructure.
Sure.
Then a novel virus grounds the entire planet to a halt. War breaks out. And he's able to step up immediately because the base is already built.
Let's actually demystify what a BSL-3 or Biosafety Level 3 facility actually entails, because it really validates that peacetime analogy.
Okay, yeah, what is it?
A BSL-3 lab isn't just like a clean room. It is a highly engineered environment designed specifically to handle lethal airborne pathogens. We're talking about negative air pressure systems, so air only flows in and never out. We're talking rigorous decontamination protocols, highly specialized ventilation, and intense training just to be able to walk through the door safely.
Okay, so you can't just throw some money at an empty warehouse and call it a BSL-3 lab when a pandemic hits.
No, absolutely not. It takes years of meticulous administrative and technical discipline to maintain that kind of facility.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because Prudencio had spent decades developing that exact operational muscle for malaria and other pathogens, his environment was already primed.
Ready to go.
Yeah. His true value to society during the pandemic wasn't just his knowledge of virology. It was his mastery of safe, high-stakes biological logistics.
And alongside that logistical response, you see another really vital tab on his site, Science and Society Outreach, where he specifically highlights his focus on vaccine literacy.
And that connects directly back to the friction of the Valley of Death we discussed earlier.
Oh, how so?
Well, just as a discovery dies without a company to manufacture it, a manufactured vaccine dies if the public is too terrified or misinformed to actually take it.
The final mile of the journey.
The hardest mile, honestly. His focus on vaccine literacy shows an understanding that the biological science is really only half the battle.
Right.
Because if you cannot effectively communicate the safety, efficacy, and, you know, the mechanism of a vaccine to a skeptical public, the entire decades-long endeavor just fails at the finish line.
It's useless.
Yeah. Translating science into a vial and translating it into public trust are parallel necessities.
Looking at all these varied responsibilities, the malaria research, the spin-off companies, the high-level biosafety management, the public outreach, how does one person actually build the capacity for such a wide-ranging career?
It takes a long time.
Right. If we trace the architecture of his CV, we can actually see the timeline of this foundation. So let's walk through it, not just as dates, but as a strategy.
The chronological map of his career reveals so much about the patience required in modern science.
So he gets his PhD from the University of East Anglia in the UK in 2000.
Right.
Then he does a postdoctoral period at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. So his early years are spent moving across Europe, acquiring different methodologies.
Typical for early career scientists.
But then, in 2004, he initiates his malaria research back in Portugal at the IMM. And he stays there.
And that geographical anchoring is totally crucial.
Really?
Oh, yeah. From 2004 onwards, he stops moving.
Yeah.
He plants deep roots at one institution and begins steadily building compounding leverage.
Because you can't build all this stuff if you're constantly leaving.
Exactly. You cannot establish a functional BSL-3 facility, found a spin-off company, and lead a diagnostic task force if you are constantly changing universities. Those initiatives require decades of localized institutional trust.
And you see that trust compound in his recent milestones,
sure.
Right? He becomes an invited associate professor at the Faculdade de Medicina de Universidade de Lisboa in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
He completes his habilitation there in 2023. And then becomes a principal investigator at the institution in 2024.
And for listeners outside the European academic system, that term habilitation might need some context.
Oh, yeah. What does that actually mean?
Well, a PhD proves you can conduct a research project under the supervision of a senior scientist. But a habilitation is the highest academic qualification you can achieve in many European countries.
Okay.
It is a rigorous process that proves you have the capacity to independently lead, fund, and manage an entire research department from scratch. It's the ultimate stamp of administrative and scientific autonomy.
And that administrative autonomy really shines through in the meticulousness of his record keeping on the site.
It really does.
Because beyond the heavy academic and corporate milestones, there are these fascinating, very humanizing sections. Like he has an other skills tab, a miscellaneous tab.
Yeah, I love those parts.
He specifically lists a languages and translations CV that dedicates a whole page to media appearances.
The inclusion of those seemingly peripheral skills is what elevates the site from like a simple list of jobs to a comprehensive map of a professional ecosystem.
Exactly. And I noticed right there on the homepage, there is a specific, deliberate credit for a drawing by Inés Simões.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't just throw biological art on his page to make it look pretty. He credits the artist properly and visibly. It shows this awareness of the broader community that supports scientific communication.
And when you synthesize all these elements, the art credits, the translation work, the media engagement, it just reinforces the reality that a modern principal investigator must be a multifaceted executive.
Joey.
We see in his advanced teaching section that he is an active educator. We see in his peer revision work that he acts as an evaluator for the broader scientific community.
He's wearing so many hats.
He operates as an HR director, a public relations representative, an intellectual property manager, and an educator, all while trying to decode the biology of a deadly parasite.
It really brings us back to the train schedule analogy we started with and how completely inadequate it is for describing a career like this.
Totally inadequate.
Because a standard resume is just a straight track.
You know,
I learned this skill, I took this job, I got this promotion. But Dr. Prudencio's digital footprint is a complex three-dimensional web.
It's an ecosystem. And biological ecosystems are resilient precisely because they are diverse.
Oh, that's a great point.
When a new threat arrives, a diverse ecosystem has the varied tools required to adapt and survive.
Which perfectly summarizes the journey we've taken through his digital footprint today.
Mm.
For you listening, we started by tracking the Plasmodium sleeper agent hiding in the liver, discovering how early intervention is the only true way to prevent the fire of a malaria infection.
Right.
We saw how those discoveries at the lab bench forced a scientist out of his comfort zone and into the boardroom, driving the launch of a spin-off company to bridge the massive financial gap of the Valley of Death.
We also uncovered how decades of quiet, rigorous biosafety and logistical training that peacetime infrastructure allowed for a rapid, high-throughput diagnostic response to the global COVID-19 pandemic.
And perhaps most importantly, we explored his advocacy for public vaccine literacy, proving that the greatest scientific breakthroughs in human history are completely useless without the communication skills to build public trust.
The core takeaway from analyzing this specific digital footprint is really a redefinition of expertise.
Yeah.
True mastery in the modern world isn't just about digging one incredibly deep hole in a highly specialized subject. It's about building a wide, adaptable network of skills that can interact with each other.
It's about building the operational infrastructure to deploy those skills exactly when and where the world needs them most.
Absolutely.
Whether that's in a venture capital pitch meeting, managing the negative air pressure of a BSL-3 facility, or sitting on the evening news explaining the mechanics of a new vaccine to a worried public.
It serves as a blueprint for the modern scientific citizen.
Which leaves us with a pretty provocative thought for you to mull over as we wrap up today. If a leading scientist today must master not only microbiology, but also entrepreneurship, patent law, crisis management, logistics, and public communication?
Are our current educational systems preparing young scientists for the reality of the job?
Exactly. It is the defining question for the future of research. We spend years training grad students how to meticulously use a pipette, but we rarely train them how to lead an organization.
It's a huge gap.
It really is.
Yeah.
If the era of the isolated genius in a white coat is truly over, if that clean, linear resume is a thing of the past, replaced by the absolute necessity of the scientist operating as a CEO and a communicator, then maybe it's time we stop looking for that simple train schedule.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time we start teaching people how to navigate the murky, sprawling ecosystem of real-world impact. Thanks for diving deep with us today. Keep questioning the structure of things.